Macbeth, A Review, by Max Beerbohm. Narrated by Alan Wayman.
Shakespeare had his shortcomings. Love of him does not blind me to his limitations and his faults of excess. But, after all, the man is dead, and I do not wish to emulate that captious and rancorous spirit, inflamed, as it often seemed to me, by an almost personal animosity, in which my predecessor persecuted him beyond the grave. Nil de mortuis nisi bonum, say I, else what is to become of the classics? In that they were directed against one who could not defend himself, I regarded Mr. Shaw's attacks as cowardly. In that Mr. Shaw was a dramatist himself, I regarded them as suspect. Yet would I have heartily approved of them had I imagined that they would induce managers not to revive certain of Shakespeare's plays quite so frequently. But I have just said that defamation of the dead will tend to destroy the classics, and so it may, if it be used discreetly. And if it do, so much the better for Shakespeare. When a play has become a classic in drama, it ceases to be a play. It may become a classic in literature without any detriment to itself, but when it becomes also, like Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet or Macbeth, a classic in drama, all, if I may be allowed to say so, is up with it. One of the reasons for the recent success of Julius Caesar was that so few persons had ever seen Julius Caesar acted. The characters and the situations were moving and impressive, were, in a word, dramatic, because, not having seen them more times than one would care to count, one did not know them all by heart. One saw the play as a play, and so derived aesthetic pleasure from it. Now that the dramatic qualities of Julius Caesar have been demonstrated, it will be revived often in various theatres. Seeing how good are the parts of Antony, Brutus, and Cassius, eminent actors will always be seizing an opportunity to play them. The thing will become a classic in drama, and one will be able to regard it only as a vehicle for acting. One will be as deadly familiar with the forum scene as with the screen scene in The School for Scandal or the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet. All its dramatic savour will have been lost. Its interest will be merely histrionic. Is Mr. A so powerful as B? You never saw B? Ah, what a performance! Not so subtle as C's, perhaps, but, oh, the way he said was this ambition. He just put his hand in his toga and, why, A holds his hand straight in front of him, misses the whole point of it. For my own part, I always thought that in some respects D's idea... Oh, nothing could be drearier than this kind of comparative criticism. Yet a classic play makes it quite inevitable. The play is dead. The stage is crowded with ghosts. Every head in the auditorium is a heavy casket of reminiscence. Play they never so wisely, the players cannot lay those circumambient ghosts, nor charm those well-packed caskets to emptiness. Hamlet and Romeo and Macbeth can be revived, but not in the literal sense of the word. Live again they do not, nor will they ever do so, unless all managers, metropolitan, suburban, and provincial, enter into a solemn compact not to revive them for a period of, say, 30 years. Give us but time to forget them and their interpreters, and then they will once more be plays. At present they are but so many parts and so many scenes, so many tests and traps for eminent mimes. For the sake of those mimes, no less than for the sake of Shakespeare, let all managers forthwith enter into the compact which I have suggested. Of all Shakespeare's plays, Macbeth is perhaps the most often enacted. It is the only one that contains two great parts, each of which, susceptible of many interpretations, can be equally well fitted to the temperaments and methods of various mimes. According to Aubrey, the play was first acted in 1606 at Hampton Court in the presence of King James. It is stated that Hal Berridge, the youth who was to have acted the part of Lady Macbeth, fell sudden sick of a pleurisy, wherefore Master Shakespeare himself did enact in his stead. One wishes that Aubrey had given some account of the poet's impersonation. It would be amusing to know Shakespeare's own view of the part. More amusing, however, than valuable, for the actor is the interpreter of the dramatist, and the creative artist is always the least competent interpreter of his own work. Besides, as I have said, there can be no final or binding interpretation of so complex a part as Lady Macbeth. Different actresses will always act the part in their different ways, and every way will have its champions among the critics, and every champion will have right on his side. Meanwhile, I find the Macbeth controversy rather tedious. Most critics of the latest production have been talking nonsense about the zeitgeist and about neurotic subtlety and pre-Raphaelitism and all the rest of it, as though the play had hitherto been acted only in the blood-and-thunder convention of Mrs. Siddons. Mere fallacy. We may be sure that the gentle poet-philosopher himself acted in much the same way as Mrs. Patrick Campbell, or, for that matter, Miss Ellen Terry. In Pepys's diary, too, there is certain evidence that Mrs. Knipp's famous impersonation was of much the same kind as that which our critics suppose to be a strange phenomenon of 1898. Thence to the Cockpit Theatre, writes Pepys in the autumn of 1667, to witness my dearest Mrs. Knipp in the tragedy of Macbeth, than which, as I did this day say to Mr. Killigrew, I do know no play more diverting nor more worthy to the eye. Did secure a prime place in the pit, whereof I was glad, being near under my Lady Dorset and her good husband. The latter did twice salute me with effusion, and I was pleased to note that those around me perceived this. Methought Mrs. Knipp did never play so fine, specially in the matter of the two daggers, yet without brawl or overmuch tragic gesture, the which is most wearisome, as though an actress do care more to affright us than to be approved. She was most comical and natural when she walks forth sleeping, the which I can testify, for Mrs. Pepys also walks sleeping at some times, and did most ingeniously mimic the manner of women who walk thus. Obviously, then, the critics are wrong in regarding Mrs. Campbell's performance as something peculiar to the spirit of this generation. In the sleepwalking scene, Mrs. Campbell was not comical, but she was very natural, and throughout the play she made her appeal to the sense of beauty and to the intellect, rather than to the sense of terror. Mr. Forbes Robertson acted in a similar way. Both took the line laid down for them by their natural method. I thought that both performances were very beautiful. It does not matter in what method Macbeth and Lady Macbeth be played, so long as they be both played well in the same method. A violent Lady Macbeth and a gentle Macbeth, or vice versa, would be a nuisance. Mrs. Campbell and Mr. Forbes Robertson act in perfect harmony. Mr. Tabor is most admirable as Macduff. Indeed, the whole production is a great success. I trust that it will be the latest production of Macbeth for many years to come.
That was Macbeth, a review, by Max Beerbohm, narrated by Alan Wayman. This recording may be freely downloaded and distributed as long as Voices of Today is credited as the author. It may not be used for commercial purposes or distributed in an edited or remixed form. For further information about Voices of Today, or to explore its catalogue, please visit voicesoftoday.org. Thank you for listening.